Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. This Tuesday evening at the Tsai Center, Boston University's African Presidential Archives and Research Center hosts the African Presidential Roundtable 2004 Public Forum. This year's symposium features 9 former African heads of state discussing a range of issues impacting U.S.-Africa relations and follows closed-door talks on the subjects. On Wednesday evening, the former presidents gather at Boston's Four Seasons Hotel for a dinner in their honor. For a look ahead at what is on Tuesday night's roundtable agenda and Wednesday night's African presidential dinner at the Four Seasons, we're joined by former U.S. Ambassador to Tanzania Charles Stiff, the current director of the African Presidential Archives and Research Center. Welcome, Mr. Ambassador.
Well, thank you, Gina. Great to be with you.
Before we talk about this important summit that is coming up featuring 9 former African presidents, I wonder if you could just tell us a bit more about the work of the African Presidential Archives and Research Center, which is hosting the event.
Well, the center is a complement to Boston University's 50-year history of focus on Africa. Mm-hmm. And what we try to bring to that mix is a focus on the present period in modern Africa's development. One of the suppositions of the center's work is that this period right now is one of the most dynamic in the history of modern Africa. The 1950s and 60s, the focus was on how Africans get their countries back.
Sure.
And now the focus is, now that they got them back, how do they make them work? Mm-hmm. And there is a real trend toward democratization and free market reform. And it's our assessment that 100 years from now, if you really want to understand why some countries have flourished and others have floundered, that it's this period in time that you'll need to focus on. And so we look at those current trends and developments on the continent, both political and economic, and we have a rather unique twist, that being that we attempt to understand this period by engaging present and former leaders on the continent.
Mm-hmm. And so democracy and free market reform are some of the things that will be discussed at this summit that's coming up with these 9 former heads of state in Africa. Some very important issues, those that we just mentioned. Also, terrorism is on the agenda. Before we get into that, though, let's hear about these former leaders who will be attending. Give us some background on them, please.
Well, the leaders that will be participating in the roundtable are all Democrats with a small D, mm-hmm. and free marketeers. They include His Excellency Nesefore Soglo, the former president of the Republic of Benin, President Ketumile Masiri, the former president of Botswana, His Excellency Antonio Monteiro, the former president of the Republic of Cape Verde, His Excellency Aristide Pereira, the former president of Cape Verde, His Excellency Flight Lieutenant Jerry John Rawlings, the Republic of Ghana, His Excellency Ali Hassan Mwinyi, the former president of Tanzania, a country that I'm a bit familiar with, Carl Hoffman, the former president of the Republic of Mauritius, and I would add that President Hoffman is presently the Belfer African President in Residence at Boston University. His predecessor, Dr. Navachandra Ramgoolam, the former prime minister of Mauritius, will also be participating. And finally, His Excellency Kenneth David Kaunda, the founding president and former president of the Republic of Zambia, who I would also add was the first Balfour African president in residence. In this group, you've got folks like Kaunda, who is one of the fathers of freedom on the continent, mm-hmm. not just Zambia. After Zambia achieved independence, President Kaunda provided safe haven for every other liberation movement in sub-Saharan Africa right there. So he is very, very much revered. That's at one end of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
At the other end of the spectrum, you've got people like Ram Gulam, whose father before him was a prime minister of Mauritius and was one of those folks that were in the leadership early on as Africa moved from colonialism to independence. Jerry Rawlings, who probably falls somewhere in the middle of that spectrum, who actually took over leadership twice by coup in Ghana, but eventually laid the foundations for democratization. And in the last election in Ghana, after having put that framework in place, his party lost the election, and he's since moved to the side, and we're fortunate that he's been involved in a number of initiatives that we've hailed at the center. President Mwinyi, who was the second popularly elected president of Tanzania after Julius Nyerere, he's a Muslim. Tanzania is a country that's 40% Islamic. And so given all of the things that are happening in the world today, to have somebody of with his history involved in the conversations that we'll be having over the next 2 weeks is particularly special.
And how is it that you're able to get this group of people together, 9 former leaders? Getting them all into one place must be quite a project.
Well, aside from me being exceptionally charming and convincing,
of course,
the more substantive reason, I think, the reasons are several. One, Boston University does have a very distinguished history as it relates to African studies. This is the second oldest African studies program in the country. There are a number of Africans who've come through Boston University who are familiar with our work here. Secondly, what we've attempted to structure in the African Presidential Archives and Research Center is an idea whose time is literally come. There's a real appreciation as more and more countries in Africa have taken democratization seriously. This issue of what do you do, how do you utilize former heads of state so that they can continue to contribute to the common weal of the countries which they led and to the continent as a whole. I mean, we have models for that sort of thing in this country. I mean, there are a lot of folks who would contend in the United States that Jimmy Carter is a much better former president than he was a president. we've come to appreciate that there are opportunities to use folks who have this unique perspective, this the unique set of insights in terms of advancing further growth and development. And we've been able to achieve some credibility in that regard. The fact that we were able to get Kenneth Kaunda as the first Belfer African president in residence has contributed significantly to our credibility. One of the people that was very, very interested in what we're doing is President Benjamin Mkapa, the present president of Tanzania, someone that I got to know very well while I was serving as ambassador there. And this is an idea that I talked about to him, albeit in much more general terms than the what we see in terms of the center becoming a reality. But he was very, very supportive, wrote colleagues all over the continent, apprising them of what I was attempting to do here at Boston University, and he encouraged their support for what we're trying to do. Thirdly, the success of the roundtable last year, the fact that the African Union, which is a successor organization of the Organization for African Unity, we're very, very interested in the work that we're doing here, are all contributing factors to our being able to engaged 9 former African heads of state.
Mm-hmm. And was last year the first year, or when did this roundtable begin?
Last year was the first year that we did the roundtable, and in part, one of the driving forces behind it was President Kaunda. We sent out a communique to former heads of state under both our signatures, and I'm realistic and humble enough to appreciate that his signature carried significantly more weight than mine. And the response that we got was significant. Last year, there were 6 former heads of state who immediately weighed in to support what we were trying to do. Others who weren't able to come expressed their regrets because of previous conflicts in their schedule. But all that left who had participated last year saw it as something worthwhile, and it was at their recommendation that we've convened this second African presidential roundtable.
You try to do it every year?
Well, the short answer is I don't know whether we'll do it every year. I do know that some of the issues that we're addressing, particularly the issue of facilitating greater flows of capital mm-hmm. to Africa, enabling African countries to have greater access to the world capital markets, is an agenda that doesn't get addressed or resolved in an instant or two. Mm-hmm. So it's something that we will have to continue to pay some attention to over time. The fact that we reconvened this year was one of the recommendations that was made last year. So the likelihood is that this is not the last roundtable that we'll host. Whether we'll do one in 2005, we've not yet made that decision.
Now, these former heads of state will be examining some very important and very timely issues. We mentioned a few of them earlier, and intertwined not only with U.S.-Africa relations, which is the focus of this event, of course, but also important on a global scale. These issues include terrorism post 9/11 and Madrid, the latter, of course, in reference to the horrific rail bombings that killed nearly 200 people recently in Spain. Also on the agenda for the summit, as you mentioned, free market reform, good governance in Africa, and democracy, a topic that we touched on earlier. So I guess I'd like to begin, Mr. Ambassador, with the matter of terrorism, because it is at the heart of so much of what the U.S. is doing in terms of foreign policy right now. And I guess the most obvious examples in relation to what the United States is doing on that front right now are the wars in Iraq and what's going on in Afghanistan. But in terms of U.S.-Africa relations and terrorism, even before President Bush declared a global war on terror, even before 9/11 and Madrid, going back several years, as you know, the U.S. and Africa shared a tragic link when it comes to terrorism, and specifically I'm talking about the bombings in East Africa of the U.S. embassies. And I know that you were the ambassador in the aftermath of that attack.
Yes, yes. I was confirmed almost 1 month to the day before they Al-Qaeda blew up the embassy in Dar es Salaam, and I went. Ironically, I mean, the date didn't mean much at the time, but my first day on African soil was September the 11th, 1998.
Well, I wonder if you could share with our listeners then how U.S.-Africa relations on the issue of terrorism have changed in the years since those bombings, and where that leaves the conversation today as these former heads of state meet to discuss the matter in the post-9/11 and Madrid world.
Interesting and ironically, some of our best potential allies in the fight against terrorism worldwide are on the African continent. One reason is reflected in the way that you frame the question, is they know the horrors of terrorism firsthand. In both Dar es Salaam and in Nairobi, exponentially more Africans were killed and injured in those bombings than were Americans. Mm-hmm. In addition, both suffered significantly in terms of the loss of revenues for tourism because at the point of the bombings, obviously, if you're a tourist, you're kind of leery of going someplace where you've had that kind of problem. Thirdly, particularly, and I can speak with some authority relative to Tanzania, the Tanzanians were extraordinarily cooperative in terms of the investigation of the bombing in August 1998 of the embassy in Tanzania. As a matter of fact, it was through the hard work of the Tanzanians that we identified the only suspect to date, which has been arrested, tried, convicted, and sentenced in the bombing of the embassy. They did the kind of mundane, hard, painstaking work that, is a part of an investigation, identified Khalfan K. Mohammed, who was one of the principals in the bombing, and not only identified him, but traced his whereabouts to the Cape area in South Africa. So there's, you know, a history here that has a powerful potential in terms of our fight against terrorism. Another thing that probably most folks in the listening audience wouldn't necessarily be aware of nor appreciate, but in October of 2001, less than a month after the World Trade Center's buildings and the Pentagon and the third plane, of course, which went down over Pennsylvania, one of the first declarations against terrorism came out of Dakar, Senegal, the Dakar Declaration. President Wad convened a meeting involving a number of African heads of state. They discussed this issue of terrorism, its implications for the United States, for Africa and the world. And they were one of the first regions in the world to collectively come together to examine this issue of terrorism and to respond that regardless of political differences, there's no place for terrorism in the global community. So, you know, we've got some real potential allies because they've been with us, you know, at steps along the way in our fight against terrorism. And another reason that African nation states have a vested interest in how this prosecution of the war against terrorism turns is that, and this was a point that was made at last year's summit, that the former heads of state who convened acknowledged that obviously we have to be involved in rebuilding Afghanistan. We obviously have to be involved in rebuilding Iraq. But the fight against terrorism should not become another reason for Africa's neglect. So how we respond to the threats of terrorism are as important for Africans as it is for us. And we would do well to engage them as partners, not only seeking their support, as we've determined relative to initiatives we need to pursue, but we also need to procure their advice about things that we ought to be doing in order to respond more effectively. And clearly one of those things that we need to be doing is to help these countries where you have nascent and burgeoning democracies and free market economies. We've got to help them succeed. Because you then start to shrink the ground where fanaticism can take root. And it's at the end of the day, it's fanaticism that we're fighting. Terrorism is only a tactic. And if people are desperate, people do desperate things. If people are frustrated, people act out of that sense of frustration. If people are alienated, they act out in ways that reflect that anger. And we would do well to listen to our partners on the continent of Africa as they offer some insights relative to how we can help countries on the continent and other developing countries around the world fulfill their potential so that their citizens feel that they have a stake, not only in their countries, but in the global community and as participants in this global economy.
And I want to talk more about that in a moment, but there are U.S. policymakers as well who will be on hand for this event that's coming up. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so they'll be hearing this message.
They will be hearing this message. And one of the great things about how these roundtables have been structured is that on the one hand, we do some closed-door sessions which enable a degree of candor that is quite frankly necessary to really getting real issues on the table. In addition to that, we do some things that are open to the general public, mm-hmm. which enables the facilitation of a greater sense of understanding on both sides, from the African perspective as well as from the American perspective. And it's those kind of very public forums that help in this bridge-building work that is so important if we're going to engage each other as partners.
You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas, and my guest is former U.S. Ambassador Charles Stith. We're talking about an historic roundtable discussion with nine former African heads of state that's taking place at Boston University this week. And, Mr. Ambassador, I want to turn now to another topic, and we've already touched on this a little bit. It's on the agenda for the summit, and that's free market reform. There was a recent article in the BU Bridge newspaper, and perhaps you saw this, that talked about Mauritius and pointed out that economically it's been a success. And I'm wondering if you could expand a little bit on that a bit more and also talk about whether or not you think Mauritius can and should serve as an example of what you've been talking about, free markets and democracy.
Well, the short answer is among Africanists as well as internationalists, there's an appreciation of this thing called the Mauritius miracle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here you've got this tiny island out in the middle of the Indian Ocean to the east of Madagascar, an island which is so small that on most maps, all you find is the word Mauritius printed out in the middle of the water.
Sure.
Nothing in the way of natural resources. It produced under colonialism cotton, sisal, sugar cane. Certainly not the sorts of things that are the foundation for a vibrant modern economy. And after independence, when they were written off by the British, the assumption was that they go straight to hell in a handbasket because of its diversity ethnically and religiously and culturally. There was a sense that it would disintegrate into a chaos driven by ethnic and religious strife. And the Mauritians came to a conclusion very quickly that they were going to either sink or swim together, and that it was in their interest to put this aside the very superficial differences that could be cause for division and to use that breadth of experience and culture that was theirs to take their country to another level. So they appreciated that their primary asset was their people, so they invested heavily in education.
Mm-hmm.
They looked around the world, made some assessments about where they could find a potential niche in terms of the global economy. Given the climate and beautiful white sandy beaches, they concluded, you know, we might be able to make some money developing our capacity as a tourism haven. So they've got 10 five-star resorts, 10 five-star knock-your-socks-off resorts. On the island. As that sector began to grow, they came to appreciate that, okay, this is important. It adds to our foreign exchange, puts us in a position to do some other things. What are the other things that we need to look at doing if we're going to create a vibrant 20th century economy? And they concluded that there might be a niche in terms of textile manufacturing and exports. And so they linked up with some partners from Hong Kong, did some joint ventures to learn the business, began to develop its capacity. And now the standard of living is such in Mauritius that they have trouble finding Mauritians who are interested in sitting behind a sewing machine. Mm-hmm. So the Mauritians are now exporting portions of the textile manufacturing export business to other places on the continent. They're doing things in Madagascar. They've been in negotiations with the Ghanaians. I understand that there are some preliminary conversations between the Mauritian businessmen and businessmen in Tanzania. And as they look to the future, they're looking to develop the financial services sector in Mauritius. I think the operative words, as other countries might look at where Mauritius is and from whence it's come, is that in a 21st century high-tech global economy, the countries with citizens who are highly educated are going to be those countries that are best positioned to do well. And so it makes sense for countries to invest in education. And the good news is that there are countries on the continent that understand this, that are making steps and strides in that direction. Botswana, before independence, no more than 10% of the Botswanan population had achieved basic literacy. Today, youth literacy rates stand at 90%, and they continue to devote 25% of their budget to education and training. In per capita terms, that's among the highest in the world. Kenya, after this most recent election, re-implemented, free primary school education. And that policy has enabled the enrollment of an additional 1.7 million students who would not have had schooling otherwise. Again, to focus back on Mauritius, in 1990, about 18% of the government's total outlays were for education. By 2000, that number bumped up to 26.7%. In Malawi, primary school enrollment has reached 3.3 million, a dramatic jump from 1.5 million in 1964. More than 600 new classrooms have been constructed and about 800 rehabilitated over the year. So there are countries on the continent that appreciate that an educated citizenry is absolutely critical if you're going to compete in a 21st century high-tech global economy. So, you know, that's a lesson to be taken from Mauritius. The other, to put it in the form of a cliche, is that you've got to have a plan and you've got to work the plan. There are a number of opportunities that are available to African countries that weren't available 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Those would include the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which has resulted in some significant advancements in terms of textile production and exportation from the continent of Africa. Last year, the African countries in the aggregate exported about $1.6 billion in textiles to the United States. If we extend and expand the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, for example, if we allow tax incentives for American businesses that partner with African countries in this regard, it could result in an additional 1.6 $4 billion in foreign direct investment in Africa. So you've got the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. You've got the Millennium Challenge Fund. President Bush has committed $5 billion to be made available to help countries that are serious about democratization and free market reform grow their economies in terms of physical infrastructure and human infrastructure. And so those are some of the things that are presently on the table. Those are some of the things that we'll be talking about, particularly in terms of how you expand and extend them. Prime Minister Tony Blair has convened this commission on Africa, which is being chaired by Bob Geldof, the Live Aid guy,
right.
Musician. 20 years ago. And Prime Minister Blair has convened this commission to prepare a report with strategic objectives to be put forward in 2005 when the UK takes over the leadership of the G8 and the European Union. I think that's an exciting prospect. One of the issues that we're going to be putting on the table that ought to be a primary consideration of the Geldof Commission is to think about ways to enable Africa to have greater access to global capital markets. And that runs the gamut from creating pools of capital, enabling African countries to access present pools of capital, to also looking at how the financial services sector evaluates Africa's potential as an investment venue. One of the things that was reported by the Bloomberg Wire Services in a story that they did earlier in the year, there was one company, and I won't mention the company in particular, but 17% of their gross profits were generated out of Africa, and that was out of countries like South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Which, since independence in 1994, has sustained 10 consecutive years of economic growth.
Hmm.
10 consecutive mm-hmm. years of economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
This past year, they registered the first real gain against the dollar. The South African rand registered the first real gain against the dollar in 15 years. That includes 5 years in the apartheid regime, which governed the country. Mm. That 17% increase in profit reflected business that this company was doing in places like South Africa, Nigeria, Botswana, Mauritius. And the take of the analyst was that a reliance to this extent on profits out of Africa diminishes the long-term value of the brand. You know, you look and you ask the question, why target and taint profits from Africa in that way? I mean, if on the one hand, a company is able to generate that level of profitability from its Africa franchises on the one hand, and then on the other hand, you've got analysts that will downgrade its stock and cost the company value on that side, what's the incentive for investing in the continent?
Hmm.
And it's those sorts of things which are perceptions based on a lack of appreciation of contemporary trends and developments that cause Africa to suffer with this albatross around its neck of neglect and exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the things of this sort that we'll be addressing in London. And then when we come to the United States, the third generation of the African Growth and Opportunity Act is presently being debated in Congress. Congressman Richard Neal, Democrat out of Springfield,
mm-hmm.
Who will be participating in the roundtable, is one of the co-sponsors of the AGOA Acceleration Act, We'll have him at the round table to talk about where they are and to hear from these African heads of state about their concerns and the things that they think are important relative to the extension and expansion of the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act.
You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. My name is Gina Cervetti, and my guest is Charles Stith, the current director of Boston University's African Presidential Archives and Research Center and former U.S. ambassador to Tanzania. And we're talking about this presidential roundtable discussion that's coming up at Boston University, in which nine former African presidents will be meeting to discuss a range of issues, some of them that we've looked at here. And, Mr. Ambassador, we've touched on terrorism, free market economies, a number of other things, democracy in Africa and how that's intertwined with U.S.-Africa relations. And as you point out, fighting terrorism, developing free markets, democracies, all of that goes hand in hand, as you noted earlier in our conversation. And I'm wondering if in this event that's coming up in regard to democracy in Africa, what else are the leaders expected to touch on? We've talked about some of the more encouraging areas on the continent. Could you touch a little bit more on some of those more positive things that are going on the democracy front and also remind us of the trouble spots in the region?
Well, I would respond to that in a couple of ways. One, we produce every year an African Leaders, what we call the African Leaders State of Africa Report, where we provide a venue for African heads of state to focus on their issues, the opportunities, their aspirations, and the things that are of concern to them relative to their respective countries. We did the report for the first time last year, and in that report we featured 13 countries.
Mm-hmm.
This year we are featuring 14 countries, and that reflects the recent election that was held in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
So the trend toward democratization and free market continues on the continent, and that's a good thing. And so that sort of issue will be something that we'll talk about. But the other thing that I'd raise is, and this might sound like a commercial break, and well, I guess it really kind of is, but not really, that one of the events that will be hosted during the roundtable will be a public forum at the Sy Center on the 27th at 6 o'clock. And it will be an opportunity for folks in the listening audience to come over and in a firsthand way hear what these guys have to say. And there'll be an open mic. So it'll be an opportunity for them to raise questions that they have, which is for us a very, very important part of this process. You know, I anticipate that some of the obvious trouble areas will be up for discussion, particularly in the public forum. The whole concern about the proliferation of HIV/AIDS on the continent. You know, that's the bad news. Good news is that governments across the continent are gearing up, expanding their efforts to take on this pandemic. And one of the things that I think, regardless of your politics, as an American, you got to feel good about the fact that the Bush administration has put $15 billion on the table to help us help deal with this pandemic. And, you know, you might argue about a preference to put the money over here versus over there. But at the end of the day, it's $15 billion that was not there before. And given that a full court press is required to deal with this pandemic, that this enables countries on the continent to make some progress in that regard. So obviously, you get in the issue of HIV/AIDS. You know, the issue that of democratization on the continent. You know, there's still some conflicts, some situations that are unresolved. The Sudan, while it looks like we might be inching closer to a peace accord that might hold, we're not there yet. Democratic Republic of the Congo is still unsettled. You had Zimbabwe, which was at one time one of the real beacons of hope on the continent, that has become something significantly less than that over the past 4 years. Those are points that will obviously be things for discussion. But, you know, again, the thing that we would hope folks would take away from the discussions in which there is an opportunity for the public to participate in is that Africa is more than the sum of its problems. That there's hope. That there's a generational leadership that has really got it. I mean, they understand that the future of the continent is going to be best secured through democratization and free market reform. And I can't remember the song, and it'll come to me. But you know, the song that went, I'll get by with a little help from my friends.
Yeah.
You know, with a little help from their friends, the future really does bode well. There are 14 countries on the continent representing a landmass larger than the continental United States, with a population larger than that of the United States, which have the potential to serve as anchor states for the continent in the same way that the 13 original colonies served as the anchors for the development of this continent.
Mm-hmm.
And with encouragement, incentives, and support, the Africa of 20 years from now can be significantly further along than the Africa of today.
You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas, and my guest is former U.S. Ambassador Charles Stiff, now director of the African Presidential Archives and Research Center at Boston University. And we're talking about a summit that the center is hosting with discussion from 9 former African heads of state. And we've been discussing a variety of issues that are expected to come up at this summit. And I want to go back to something, and if you could expand on this a little bit more, and that is investment from outside of Africa on the continent, specifically the U.S., because this summit that's coming up, after all, is in regard to U.S.-Africa relations. More investments needed. Is that accurate?
Well, the short answer is yes. And for me, these lessons, or this lesson, or this point, kind of reflects some of the experience that I gained on the domestic side. While my career of late has been shaped by my involvement with Africa and African issues, most of my career I've spent trying to get America to do things a little bit better as it relates to underserved and undercapitalized communities in our midst.
Right.
And through such mechanisms as the Community Reinvestment Act, we've seen nearly $1.7 trillion made available to undercapitalized communities over the last 7 years, which have created a veritable renaissance in most American cities. Home ownership rates have gone up exponentially all over the country, and that's resulted in other sorts of development. I'm very proud to say that I was involved in negotiating and helping to broker the first comprehensive community reinvestment agreement in the country, right here in Boston, $500 million agreement. And as a result of that, somebody who had been to Grove Hall in middle of Roxbury 15 years ago, if we blindfolded them and took them there today and let them out the car, they wouldn't recognize where they were. And a very valuable lesson came out of that for me. And that is that capital is the mother's milk of economic growth and development. Without capital, there's no growth. Without capital, there's no development. And so it is relative to Africa. If African countries are going to realize their potential, it's going to mean a greater access to credit and capital. In part, that starts with encouraging higher rates of saving within countries. But it also results in them having greater access to the world capital markets. I mean, part of that means the countries getting sovereign credit ratings by the global rating authorities. But it's interesting. At the end of the day, and I really mean this, at the end of the day, whether countries are considered prime places for investment really hinges on folks making the decision that those places are prime places for investment. You know, when we turned the corner on Russia and started to see billions of dollars in investment flow into Russia and those states making up the former Soviet Union, it was not because they had somehow miraculously evolved into paradigms of democracy. Mm-hmm. It wasn't because they had somehow miraculously developed pristine and transparent economies, but it was because folks made a decision that Russia's time was now. The same thing can be said for China. China's time is now. And because of that, capital was steered in the direction of those two countries. And, you know, we've suffered through some travail as both of those countries have worked to privatize, regularize their economies and make them more transparent. And, you know, with that kind of sustained commitment, we're seeing some changes begin to take place. And I would submit that the same sort of thing needs to happen relative to Africa. One of the things that Bob Geldof made mention of in talking about, you know, understanding Africa's problems, and I think he really had his finger on something. He said that Africa's problems can't only be the result of corruption, debt, AIDS, and conflict. He went on to say, the West has such problems in spades. It's just that the West is rich enough to surf them, and down there they die, speaking of Africa. Mm-hmm. There's a transformation in perceptions that have to take place. One of the reasons that I looked forward to this opportunity for us to have this conversation, and I really appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation, is that more often than not, what are the images that the world sees relative to Africa? What's the news out of Africa on a regular basis? It tends to be those things that are negative. The images, bloated babies with bulging eyes, with flies swarming around their heads, young men, young women emaciated from HIV/AIDS. What you don't see are the construction of the classrooms about which I spoke earlier. I mean, what you don't see is the fact that the South African government has produced over 1 million new units of housing since it took over from the apartheid regime. And what you don't see is that there are 2 million more homes in South Africa that have electricity now and working toilets that didn't have them before. What you don't see is that the University of Witwatersrand, the quote-unquote Harvard of South Africa, or as the South Africans would say, that Harvard is the Witwatersrand of the United States. You don't see the kind of diversity in terms of the complexion of that campus that was unfathomable in 1993, a year before apartheid ended. And those are things that not only bode well in an absolute sense for South Africa's future, but those are the sorts of things that if people saw more of them would have an appreciation for Africa's potential. And look, at the end of the day, nobody likes to bet on a losing cause. And if you're looking at where you can invest money to get a return on that investment, you're going to go where the profit potential is most promising. And, you know, our assessment is that if we can turn the corner on perception, then Africa will be able to turn the corner on poverty.
All right. And so I guess that's the bottom line as we approach this summit that's coming up with the 9 former heads of state of African countries. Mr. Ambassador, is there anything that you'd like to say as we wrap up our conversation this evening?
No, I mean, nothing other than, again, to thank you for making this opportunity available to talk about the work of the African Presidential Archives and Research Center and about some of the very exciting things that are going on the continent. And just once again, I'd invite people to come over to the Sy Center on the 22nd of April for the public forum involving these former heads of state. It starts at 6 o'clock, and we'd love to see them there.
And there's, I just want to mention, too, that there is a dinner that's taking place as well, right, the following day?
That's right. There is a, the event at the Sy Center is free and open to the public. As a celebratory event to mark the conclusion of the roundtable, there will be a black tie African presidential dinner where these 9 former heads of state will be honored.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for speaking with BU World of Ideas. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure indeed. Thank you.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Tanzania Charles Stith, also current director of the African Presidential Archives and Research Center at Boston University. For information on attending this Tuesday night's African Presidential Roundtable 2004 Public Forum at the Sy Center, or this Wednesday night's African Presidential Dinner at the Four Seasons in Boston, honoring the 9 former presidents participating in this year's forum, call 617-353-5452. That's 617-353-5452. For a cassette or CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Michael Garth and Matt Largy, with help from George Hicks. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.